The following content is sponsored by Atlantis Sports Clubs and does not reflect the views of WATD Radio. It's Friends with Benefits on 95.9 WATD, exploring relationships, social issues, sports, and life stories. Be a part of the show at 781-837-4900. This is Brian Stratton's Friends with Benefits with your hosts, Paul Kearney, Gabe Sirota, Joe Coletti, and Bob Anderson.
Hello, and welcome back to another Thursday night show of Blue Sierra's Telehealth Radio. I'm flying solo for this interview without my wingman, Joe. I'm definitely missing him tonight, but it's still going to be a great show. Joining me tonight is Dr. Michael Minna, the Chief Science Officer for EMED Labs. He was a professor of epidemiology and immunology and infectious diseases at Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He's also a professor in the Department of Pathology at Harvard Medical School and an associate medical director of molecular virology at Brigham and Women's Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Minna. Thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you so much, Michelle. It's great to be here.
We've heard a lot, and we talk a lot on this show about telehealth and how telehealth can help individuals access care more quickly, make it more accessible, make it therefore more equitable across the country, no matter anyone's zip code, for example. And we're always trying to inform our listeners of the benefits of receiving remote care and even in their homes and how they can do that. And we brought the show tonight, this innovative product that you have, EMED Lab or EMED, and your test to treat technology. Please tell our listeners about this test to treat and what is this all about?
Yeah, test to treat, and in particular, in this case, home test to treat, is it's an evolution of what happens in brick and mortar medical sites. So, of course, during this pandemic, we found that there was this great need for individuals who were becoming positive on tests, whether it was at their doctor's office or at home, to then find their way to a physician's office to be evaluated for treatment and ultimately ordered, in the case of COVID, Paxlovid, but that could be extended to any number of different ailments. But one of the biggest barriers to positive outcomes in healthcare are delays in treatment, which are generally born from low access to getting care. And by that, we usually mean difficulties getting to the doctor's office. It's hard for people to find a doctor who can see them when they turn positive on a rapid test, when they get sick with a UTI. All of these different ailments are really sort of urgent in the sense of infectious diseases. You need to start treatment quickly. And so where telehealth comes in today is it gives people ready access to physicians, sometimes even on demand, usually with a click of a button. And it's something that EMED is doing is specifically tailoring our telehealth experience for people to specific ailments. So somebody who has COVID and knows it from an antigen test can be immediately brought through a medical clinical visit through telehealth, be evaluated by a physician, and ultimately get prescription medication if that's warranted for that individual, either directly sent to their home or a prescription could be sent to their local pharmacy to be picked up. And so this is really leveraging the internet and the advances over the last couple of decades in communication and telecommunications to be able to say, look, not everything requires people to make their way to a doctor's office and go through all of the expense and time and burden to do that, when the reality is we can be doing many of these things very simply, very quickly, and therefore more effectively with better outcomes through telemedicine. And that's it's the pandemic has led to a large shift towards medicine via telehealth. And I think we're only just now starting to see the beginnings of this.
No question about that. We've talked many times on this show about how telehealth has just expanded, the use of technology to help them enable to access care. And what I think is great about this product, and you referenced it around COVID, but this is available 24/7. Someone can get a test result within 15 minutes, but it's not just COVID, right? You have other tests as well. Tell our listeners a little bit about what tests you have and how does this work?
Yeah, that's right. So we now have an urgent care kit, which we think of a little bit like a first aid kit for telehealth. And it's something that you have sitting under your cabinet or in your medicine cabinet for when you need it. And so what it covers today is it covers COVID, influenza screening, strep throat, and UTIs. And the reason we chose these four to start is because they generally account for around 80% of urgent care visits today that could reasonably be treated from home through telemedicine. And so we're really trying to bring people access to telehealth in a new way. So the way that it works is somebody has these kits at home. They have, for example, if you think you might have a UTI, you do one of these rapid UTI tests. And depending on the result of that, if you're positive, you're immediately brought into a telemedicine visit through eMed, where you're evaluated usually within minutes, and a prescription is sent to your pharmacy of your choice, which is usually right down the road from people, for you to start on treatment very, very quickly without having to go through the burden of getting to an emergency room. So our hope is that overall in this economy where healthcare costs are just increasingly increasing the debt for Americans, that we can start to really bring back the costs. And so some of the ways that we're doing this is we're offering these types of telehealth sessions in a way that is a little bit out of the ordinary, in the sense that there's no hidden fees. There's at the moment, people don't have to have insurance. You can just buy a kit for $25 and that gets you the test, it gets you the telehealth visit, and it gets you the treatment, all included in that $25. And so we've tried to price it in a way that is really pretty accessible and also can work for people who don't have any insurance, that really anyone can access it. And actually the majority of our customers have even been public health departments who want to get these types of kits into people's homes as public health programs, even to be able to almost provide healthcare telemedicine visits to constituents in sort of a new and innovative way.
Makes complete sense. And I think, driving the cost out of healthcare is so important. We know this by all the data that points to, that the United States in particular spends so much money in healthcare relative to other industrialized countries. When you think about the use of this at-home test process, are there other tests that you hope to, you could said that you cover 80%, are there other tests that you hope to expand to? And then what about its use even internationally, where they may not even have accessibility to tests even in a doctor's office?
Yeah, so certainly moving into the international space is something that we're very interested in pursuing. But it is tricky, being able to tie into healthcare systems, prescribing systems, payment structures in other parts of the world. Each country is different, but it is something that we're actively pursuing, as we work towards working in the UK and Canada, for example. Both of these have more national health service, universal healthcare types of approaches, which comes with its difficulties, but also its benefits. For example, in a place like the UK, the average individual just isn't used to paying for their healthcare. It's paid for by the government, but that comes with strings, oftentimes with long delays to get into a primary care setting. So there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out how do we fuse these new innovations in telemedicine with things like universal healthcare, National Health Service in the UK, to be able to bring people faster access to healthcare through telemedicine in a way that's sort of a public-private partnership. And so those efforts are certainly ongoing. Your other question was around what other types of kits might we be bringing out to people. We're really looking at, where are the needs, especially from public health perspective. Things like PrEP, pre-exposure prophylaxis for HIV, is very hard for people not only to get onto, but then to stay on, because they often have to get, they have to get tested every couple of months or every few months to be sure that they don't yet have HIV in order to get their next prescription for pre-exposure prophylaxis. And so a lot of people kind of fall off the wagon, if you will, just because they can't get to the doctor's office to get that blood draw for the test. And so we want to bring the test to them in their home, bring public health to the people, and really allow them to be like, make it as convenient as possible. And so that's a lot of what drives us at eMed is how do we take something that's oftentimes burdensome, especially things that have big public health implications like COVID and flu, and strep throat, UTIs, and soon HIV, colorectal cancer screening, kidney disease. All of these are massive public health issues that generally can be greatly decreased in terms of their burden on the population with improved screening, faster screening. And that all requires making it more accessible and easier for people to have at home, rather than waiting for waiting to see the doctor, which we know that Americans are very good at delaying how frequently they see the physician. And so by bringing this into the home, it really decreases most of the barriers to entry to these types of screening programs, or pre-exposure prophylaxis programs, or just urgent care, gets people on the road to recovery much quicker, or to resolving what issue might come up in screening much quicker. And so that's really where eMed is focusing. Where sort of can we bring home diagnostics together with healthcare through telemedicine? That's kind of the sweet spot that we try to live in for public health.
Makes perfect sense. I think that when you think about that, as our listeners are listening to this show, you know, how many of us have thought, oh, I need to get, go to the doctor because I need a UTI, and you might have a UTI, or I love the idea of your expansion to HIV. I mean, that's probably, for those patients or folks that are in those treatment cycles, very stressful scenarios where they know that they've missed, a test and not sure where they stand in terms of their level of infection or their level of, getting their prescriptions for their next treatment cycle. These are, real patients, real people that are living their lives, and this can make it easier. And I think, it's all about what we talk about on a regular basis here on Luceris Radio, which is taking healthcare and bringing it to the patient, rather than us in our traditional sense going to a brick and mortar location, waiting, and all the inconvenience around that. Even if it's not in a convenient space, this is real, as you mentioned, public health challenges around, in some cases, sexually transmitted diseases and other types of public health issues like COVID and other viruses that are easily transmittable. But we know in healthcare that public policy and regulation is part of our life. And so home tests, are not as accessible right now, in part because of regulation. So speak to us a little bit about the challenges that you've had and what our listeners can do and what our other healthcare professionals can do to help move this forward.
Yeah, so one of the biggest issues that we saw with COVID and we see across the board is that we live in a regulatory landscape where the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, is not has not traditionally been comfortable with Americans having access to tests at home, especially tests that they interpret do the whole thing on their own at home, like a COVID rapid antigen test. And that really limits where telehealth can come in and help people. Because what we've found is, in the absence of tests being available at home for other ailments, telemedicine providers are generally kind of relegated to sort of guessing what's wrong with their patient, because the patient doesn't have access to data like they would if they were in a brick and mortar site where the patient is getting a laboratory test, maybe right there at the doctor's office, and getting that result that the physician then can make a very informed decision on. So a great example of this is strep throat, or actually a better example is influenza. Influenza has a treatment called Tamiflu. That's one of the major treatments, but it needs to be started very, very fast. Usually within 2 days of symptom onset, you have to start taking Tamiflu in order for it to be particularly effective. So if we're asking people to go to the doctor's office to get a test, before they can start on Tamiflu, generally people will already be past 2 days of symptom onset before they even go to the doctor. So it really limits the ability for people to benefit in this country from drugs like Tamiflu that are really life-saving for many, many people who get influenza. With telehealth, we have the opportunity to greatly reduce the time from symptom onset to getting somebody a prescription for Tamiflu. And telehealth physicians know that because it's very easy. If I wake up this morning with a scratchy throat and I don't know what's wrong with me, I can get on the phone with a telehealth provider, within minutes and be evaluated for flu. But without a flu test in the home, essentially the physicians are relegated to just wondering does my patient really have flu? And in the absence of a test, essentially providers have to go with what's likely the lowest risk, but the most benefit. And so they just end up prescribing Tamiflu, even if the person just has adenovirus.
Right.
And so that becomes a real issue that, we have providers just prescribing drugs, which might not even be right, but it's because they don't have evidence to the contrary to say, no, this isn't flu. So instead, because Tamiflu doesn't have much risk associated with it, it doesn't really have any adverse effects, doctors are prescribing it just based on symptoms alone. So imagine if instead that doctor said, well, John Doe, why don't you take out your flu test from underneath your sink and out of your medicine cabinet and let's get you started. Let's see if you have flu. You can do it right there on your own while we're on a call. And within a few minutes, you'd know the patient, the doctor would be able to feel very confident prescribing Tamiflu or confident in saying, look, it's very unlikely you have flu. This is probably another respiratory virus. Do you have a COVID test? Why don't we use that too and make sure you don't have COVID? So we're really handcuffing telemedicine right now by not getting these kinds of tools out to Americans. And in the absence of regulatory environment kind of enabling them to come to market, telemedicine and the internet are just kind of jumping forward, but kind of doing it in, I look at this as sort of the ugly duckling phase of telemedicine. And I think over the next few years, we're going to see many of these tools come to fruition that really allow the telemedicine experience to be, effectively, very, very similar to an in-person experience in terms of all the data that will be available to the physician.
Hey, Joe, please tell me about your new company, Blue Cirrus Consulting. This is a new way I can actually stay home and receive quality healthcare by using today's technology?
Yeah, thanks. It's called telehealth. It's sweeping the nation. It's great. It saves lives, it saves time, and it saves money.
Great, but why isn't my hospital offering it to me?
Well, hospitals are being flooded with new software vendors and technology, making it difficult for hospitals to make clear decisions and choose which telehealth program is right for them. In fact, Blue Cirrus Consulting can bring telehealth to local hospitals here in New England. We have a track record of providing skilled advisors, clinicians, and project leaders to support your hospital and help them accomplish a quality telehealth program.
Hey, Joe, how do I find out more information?
Thanks, Paul. You can go online at blue-cirrus.com. That's blue as in the color, dash Cirrus, C-I-R-R-U-S, as in the cloud, .com, and find all of our company information online. Blue Cirrus saves lives, saves time, and saves money.
I'm excited to introduce our next guest, Dr. Jonathan Gleason, the Executive VP and Chief Clinical Officer at Prisma Health. Hello, Dr. Gleason. Thank you for joining the show.
Hi, I'm happy to be here tonight with you. I appreciate it.
It's great to have you, Dr. Gleason, and we're fascinated to learn about the work that you're doing with patients with intellectual and developmental disabilities. It's interesting because you're currently, leading one of the largest physician groups in the country and a physician scientist yourself. Your background, your practice is in OBGYN, yet you wrote a paper in this area, which created so much buzz, so much interest in this space. Tell us how that came to be.
Sure. So, Michelle, it is kind of an amazing and unlikely story, but during the pandemic, I was the chief clinical officer at a large health system in Philadelphia, Jefferson Health, and was overseeing the clinical aspects of the pandemic response. And one of the things that that my team observed is we were supporting a lot of long-term care facilities and safety during the first year of the pandemic was a long-term care facility that really catered to and focused on individuals with intellectual disability. They had an outbreak of COVID, and it really was a sort of devastating situation. And what occurred to us was that at that point, pre-vaccine, all the strategies for mitigating the risk of COVID were behaviorally based, right? Wear a mask, wash your hands, keep your distance, all things that people can do if they have typical control of their abilities. These folks didn't have typical control of their abilities. And so the impact was very, very dramatic. And so, you know, just given my sort of data science background and research background, had access to a large database, 64 million US patients, and put together an analysis. And you know, I remember where I was, I remember what I was doing. I remember everything about the call that I got from our statistician, where the results showed that individuals with intellectual disability in the first year of the pandemic, they had that risk factor of having an intellectual disability was the strongest independent risk factor for getting COVID-19 in the first year. And it was the second strongest independent risk factor for dying from COVID-19. And this was happening in March of 2021. We got these results, and this is the vaccine was very scarce, and there was a lot of focus on what was the ethical way to allocate the vaccine, you know, to people who are at the highest risk. And here we have these results, and this was unknown. And so within days, the paper was published in the New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst. And within 2 weeks, civil rights lawsuits have been filed around the country. And Japan had adjusted their prioritization to include individuals with intellectual disability, India, other countries. And it really became a global movement around this community that was at such a greater risk. So it really was an extraordinary experience. And, you know, it would be a long story to tell you all the things that have happened since then, but to summarize it is that there is increased attention on this community, their vulnerabilities, and the need for us not to just be available to them, but to be truly accessible, which means with this population, pursuing them in new and different ways. And I think that's what we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
That is very exciting. And it's great that you were able to make such a difference across the globe with your research. So congratulations.
Yeah, excellent work. Dr. Gleason, would you agree patients with IDD often have poor access to healthcare, which contributes to receiving care infrequently and exacerbates existing conditions?
The evidence on that, Joe, is very clear that they access care less frequently than people that don't have intellectual disability, even controlling for other factors like social determinants of health, insurance status, that type of thing. So there's no question that they access care less often. Okay, that is very clear in the data. And the other thing to know about this population is that their life expectancy is 20 years less than the rest of the U.S. population. So they access less care, they receive less care, their life expectancy is 20 years shorter. And the cost of the care that we're providing to them is very high. So it's, you know, about 1 to 3% of the U.S. population has intellectual disability. It's about 5% of the Medicaid population has intellectual disability, and they represent about 15% of the cost, right? So here we have an example with a very vulnerable community that isn't accessing care, that has poor health outcomes and exceedingly high costs. So that really is the shortest way I can summarize the situation. And a lot of that is because accessibility with this population, again, as I said earlier, it looks different. Being available to them is insufficient. We have to go to them, right? So, you know, that's where virtual care really comes into play, and also residential programs for individuals with intellectual disability, where there are wraparound services and care models that are literally there at their elbow, right? There's a real, there's a very significant need for very coordinated care. And the virtual option is particularly attractive because many people with intellectual disability also have social anxiety. And so there can be a misperception that people with intellectual disability or other neurodevelopmental issues may be less able to use virtual, but that's actually not true. There's real evidence around that that's been developed. A couple of papers have been published. You know, the business community knows that. One example is that, you know, esports is one of the fastest growing phenomenons in the world, right? It's really amazing what's happened. If you don't believe me, talk to a 12-year-old, okay? And so esports is growing like crazy. And one of their target markets are people with intellectual disability or autism. You know, that's a way for them in a low anxiety situation to participate with other people. in activities. And so, you know, they're as businesses becoming autism friendly and neurodiversity friendly, because that is something that some aspects of that community actually really, really enjoy.
That's a great point. I didn't consider that esports would actually be a way for IDD patients to participate. And again, as you said, have a low anxiety level. I'm glad you mentioned the virtual care. We spent a lot of time talking and working in the virtual care space here at Blue Cirrus. And one of the things that we've seen in some of the data that we've been privy to is patients that have IDD or that have behavioral health disabilities and other exacerbating conditions, that they are actually some of the highest utilizers of virtual care. And if that virtual care was not available to them, then we would have a crisis on our hands for those patients, because as you mentioned, many of them have social anxiety, and so getting to the offices is too difficult. You have to go to them. But we talked in our last interview about some of the challenges that we have in a regulatory environment. I won't put you on the spot on this, but the DEA is sunsetting some of the controlled substances prescribing availability in virtual care. So another reason why this is so important for us to reach out to our legislators and note that these are real concerns and real problems for people should they need to have this care. But what other care models are you aware of, Dr. Gleason, that are there to help IDD patients across the globe?
Well, I think your point is really a very good point, is that access to virtual care for this population is just access to care, because we know they're not accessing care in bricks and mortar, right? So right. This is not about accessing virtual care. This is about accessing care, period.
Correct. It's about leveling the playing field. It's equity exactly. In that case.
Right. So, you know, people talk a lot about access, and what they're thinking and what they're actually talking about is availability. Again, availability is not good enough when you get into really vulnerable populations for social determinants reasons or for intellectual disability reasons. You know, and obviously the intersection of disability and social determinants of health is a place where there's particularly profound, you know, issues in access and healthcare outcomes. But, you know, to your question about, you know, what are some examples of some, you know, care models? Obviously, you know, there are quite a few large residential facilities around the country and small ones as well, where they have wraparound services and, you know, therapists, and they have in some cases physicians and advanced practice clinicians that are there, you know, working with them. And so that's one model. And obviously it's insufficient, because we know they're still receiving less access to care. The evidence is really clear. But, you know, virtual care models are also really emerging in this population. I'll share one example, a company called Genial Care in Brazil, which is actually founded by US-based founder who really went to Brazil in order to develop a virtual first, fully integrated care model for that population, meaning they can get their ABA therapy, they can get their, you know, their occupational therapy and speech therapy, things that they couldn't otherwise access because of cost reasons. And it's maybe not quite as good as in-person, but it's a lot better than no care.
Yeah.
And also providing care to their, you know, to their family members. You know, when you're working with patients that have intellectual disability, there's not just the patient, there's the patient and also the caregivers. So, you know, there's evidence out there that mothers of children with intellectual disability have similar stress hormone levels as soldiers at war. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they are in many cases not well, and they need care too. And so that's one of the other sort of beauties of virtual care, is you can do it all, you know, and these folks live very complicated, difficult lives. Getting a child that has behavioral issues into a car to go to a physician where they're scared of that, and then sitting in a waiting room, and then, you know, getting them back to the waiting room, and then sitting through an exam. These are things that just the barriers are just stack up, mm-hmm. you know. So I think that a virtual first model for individuals with intellectual disability, especially those with significant behavioral problems, that's really what access looks like. You know, that's what the opportunity is.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a great point. I want to ask you, what are some of the important steps providers can take to improve outcomes for patients with IDD?
I think a couple of things. One is to ensure that your staff are aware of this. They can see these patients and understand their unique challenges. And so there are training resources that are available through Special Olympics International, through the Institute for Exceptional Care, two great groups that are working on making care more accessible. This population, so I think that's a very simple thing that you can do. The other thing that you can do, and something that I've done in the past, is in your digital systems, your EHRs, et cetera, you know, create a way for your team members to know when they're scheduling that patient about their particular needs and account for that when they're scheduling the patient, right? So that maybe they have a little bit more time, account for the fact that they're going to have other team members with them, a caregiver, and make sure that you got all the resources that are available for them there. And then the last thing, it would be to familiarize yourself with your local network of physicians and therapists that treat these patients, right? And recognize when they're not getting the care that they need, and help plug them into those resources. So those are a couple of things.
So important to have that whole person care, as you're pointing out, that we are really considering the patient and have it be at the center of what is occurring in the patient care setting. And it's so often that it's easy for us, and especially in primary care facilities, to just, you know, continue and have the patients coming in as normal. And that's not always the case for folks. And I would say, even in populations that we've dealt with across the country, where they not only have IDD, and as I mentioned before, other complex health conditions, but they also have a homeless scenario. So now we have even more barriers in place for those patients, and how do we get to them the best way that we possibly can, finding different care models for those folks. So thank you for your advice in that space.
Sure.
Yeah, this
is the most important thing. The most important bottom line is you have to really choose to see these patients, and you have to create systems where you can identify them. And I think if you were to go to health system level, we have to begin to measure health outcomes in this population and report out about that. And we have to choose that we're going to pursue them, really, is the bottom line.
So the work that you and I have done together that brought even us together over the years is around the telehealth work that you do. Mm-hmm. And tell us, how is that going? What have you been doing? And what's the status?
Yeah, let me talk about telehealth, because it was just kind of a something in the background 3 years ago. And it really wasn't until COVID, Michelle, that, you know, telehealth became a hot topic. And you know, they talk about being nimble in IT. Well, when COVID kind of took off and we had no other choice, but how are we going to care for our patients? Because we didn't know a lot about COVID and what it could do, but we knew we still had to take care of our patients. So talk about quickly activating and deploying a technology. We had some of the technology, but we didn't have the full infrastructure for telehealth to really make it as robust. And I think that's really where BlueSiris and your partners came in to help us. And I think that's important for a critical access hospital. We do a lot of things really well, but we can't do everything well. And it's okay to call on those resources that could help us. And I think that's where BlueSiris came in and offered some support to help us, you know, build that infrastructure and get it off the ground. And how do we creatively support telehealth? Because it's different for a mom with, you know, young children than it is with, you know, in the aging population or, you know, a patient, a behavioral health patient. So, boy, I'm very proud of the telehealth work we did. And has it evolved? It's gotten better. You know, we learned, you know, from our mistakes. It's gotten better, but it's changed, you know, since, you know, maybe the last 6 months or last year. And it's changed not just for our patients, but for our providers and our clinicians. You know, rather than, you know, doing it every day, now we have maybe designated times that we specify for telehealth, which actually has increased our work-life balance for some of our clinicians too, because you could do telehealth almost, not everywhere, but almost anywhere. So it evolved. And I think that's a great lesson learned white paper someday, if I get any spare time, to sit down and really write our story.
Yeah, definitely. And it helps the physicians to be able to have that work-life balance that you were describing. You know, it helps you retain those clinicians. They're able to work from home. And we talked about that a lot on this on this radio show. So these innovations and how they can help you really with capacity planning across the organization, because we know healthcare shortages, we've talked about that, and we talked about that with our first guest, these physician shortages and nursing shortages, they're really, really no joke. Not only because we are graduating some people from nursing school and medical school, but too many are retiring or leaving the profession entirely just because of the kind of great resignation post-COVID. And because of that, that's created a changing landscape, right? We've got everything, all these different types of innovations that are trying to happen to help to make healthcare more efficient and to help the clinicians be able to work more efficiently. And this type of changing landscape is directly related to the innovation that comes out of the IT department. So I know you've been dealing with this and how that you keep up with the latest and greatest, and how do you manage the staffing around that? Because not every expert is going to live in Peterborough, New Hampshire.
No, I mean, the whole staffing conversation, retention and recruitment, I think I spend probably, I make it an effort to spend 50% of my time just on staffing and recruitment and maintaining the staff that I have here within IT. So it's not a secret. You know, there's not a lot of, you know, 20 somethings that want to come live in Peterborough, you know, that it's not the Boston, New York or LA of the world, but we do offer maybe a different variety, different lifestyle. But what we can offer is hybrid. I use the word hybrid and getting creative. But for staffing, we had some significant challenges during COVID, and we lost, you know, 50% of the IT staff for various reasons. And that's a huge turnover when, you know, the average tenure here within IT was like 20 years. I have a lot of us long timers, but we also had some significant turnover. And at a point, I have to support the organization, the infrastructure, and I can't continue to work the hours that we were working. It was exhausting. So we actually explored it, never in the history of Monadnock Hospital IT, but outsourcing, outsourcing IT. That gets scary. People don't like that term. So rather than using the word outsource, I called it staff augmentation, because I'm still here. I still get paid by Monadnock Hospital, but we partnered with an organization called Altera to bring in some that high-level skilled resources that we couldn't recruit in Peterborough, and we augmented it with the staff that we have here. So there are some embedded in our staff are Altera employees, a high-level security analyst, IT security, something that keeps me up at night, and it certainly should keep many of you up at night. Yeah. Senior-level engineer skills that, again, that you'd see in Boston or that you would see in New York, and then also just general managed services, you know, leadership that to help with strategy, to help supplement, because I'm wearing so many hats, but also a lot of global resources, things that can be done automated or just routinely that are being done in India. So that way it can focus the team that's here, we call it that tribal knowledge, the resident experts, and allow us with the history of Monadnock Hospital and IT infrastructure to do the work that we know how to do every day without the mundane day-to-day tasks. So we're in year number 1.5 of this relationship. It's a 3-year partnership. And it was a little bumpy at first because, Michelle, we're dealing with some new cultures that Monadnock hasn't had. And, you know, if anything, I could share, I guess, the silver lining of this experience. It was challenging. We had to accept change and embrace new cultures, and the manager of service delivery for this initiative actually relocated from India. He came here with his family, his daughter, his 7-year-old daughter, and I had the privilege of integrating him, not just into Monadnock Hospital, into our infrastructure, to our policies and procedures, but into our community. And I embraced this experience by going to the local schools, the elementary school, and teaching them how to enroll somebody into our school systems, going to the town office and how to register a car. That sounds something that you and I take for granted. But when you're from another country and in an automobile and car insurance and grocery shopping, and also integrating him into our, you know, MCH family by, you know, different foods in our cafeteria. So if anything, you know, the change of bringing in, you know, outside resources and managed services, it has really enhanced our internal relationships and acceptance. So when you talk about equity, diversity, inclusion, and belonging, this is a model that I would love to share with others. And I didn't read a book. I didn't, you know, read something online. It's something that just aligns with our core values, maybe at the way I was raised, but our values here at Monadnock Hospital is compassion, collaboration, honesty, and respect. Yeah. And it's easy to see that in a sign when you walk into an organization, but this is how we live it every day. And it's not just me. It's my colleagues that embrace this culture, diversity. And I'm so proud and so excited that Friday evening, we all went bowling as a family to celebrate. Advika is the 7-year-old for her birthday and has never really done candlepin bowling. And we had pizza and a bunch of 7-year-olds running around. So that's just, and when I say Monadnock Hospital is special, that's an example of, you know, we live by our mission, and that's being committed to improving the health and well-being of our community. And I'm a member of our community. I'm a patient here. My kids were born here. So sure, I run the IT show on a day-to-day basis, but it's more than that. And if anything, I hope, you know, others feel that same way when you go to work every day. And that's what makes Monadnock special.
You told that story so beautifully, and it's real life, right? For those mm-hmm. of you that, for those listening and may be aware, but in rural areas, and I think particularly in Peterborough and the Monadnock, you do have that sort of connectiveness and your mm-hmm. acceptance of folks that are coming in there and creating that connectiveness across mm-hmm. your organization. Because it's not unusual, right, for folks to have lived and worked and be born at the same hospital their whole careers. It's usually a large employer in the town. Mm-hmm. And so lots of people have either worked at the hospital or have worked at some point. Mm-hmm. So those are all really important and such a special opportunity to be able to shepherd somebody from another country and teach them about the cultural differences and vice versa, right? I'm sure.
Oh, absolutely.
Experience the Atlantis Sports Club difference. Atlantis Sports Club and Spas are located throughout Massachusetts, including locations in Dedham, Danvers, and Hyannis. Featuring state-of-the-art cardiovascular and strength training equipment, plus indoor and outdoor pools and full-service spas, Atlantis offers something for everyone. Swim lessons for the kids or a luxurious spa treatment. Your Atlantis membership allows access to all locations. Atlantis in Dedham is located at 25 Allied Drive at the Hilton Hotel in Dedham. When you're on the North Shore, check out the Danvers location located at Ferncroft at the Hilton, next to Water Park of New England. Take a mini vacation at Atlantis Sports Club and Spa in Hyannis. Play golf, then relax by the resort-style pool. Mention this ad and receive 20% off any spa treatment. Experience the Atlantis difference today. Visit AtlantisSportsClubs.com and book your tour today.
Right now, for a limited time, get 40% off a family four-pack of fun at Water Park New England, Indoor Golf, and Atlantis Sports Club, all included. For more information, visit AtlantisSportsClubs.com and buy your fun pass today.
I know that in the name, it says the Great Plains, but talk to us a little bit about where you cover the states that you cover in your area and the types of projects that you're working on.
Sure. Yeah, there's a little bit of history in the names, and it goes back to when the TRCs were formed. They actually, originally, there were only six of them, And HRSA, OAT at the time, put out a NOFO and groups applied. And then over time, we just kind of groups came along and claimed some states and traded some states at some point. And so we ended up with the states that we have. But we are great, what we call Great Plains is kind of northern Great Plains. Sometimes we get even called the Great Lakes region. But it's in short, what I say is Minnesota and everything that surrounds it, which includes North and South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, and Wisconsin. So those six states are our focus area. What we do, and this is true for all of the telehealth resource centers, though we are a very diverse group, there are 14 of us altogether, but what we do, there are 12 regionals, we're one of the regionals, and what the regionals do is we keep tabs on policy and telehealth programs in our region, try and connect the dots for folks, provide sort of baseline introductions to telehealth, work with safety net and rural and underserved providers who serve rural and underserved folks, helping them establish, evaluate, sustain, and expand telehealth programs of all kinds across the gamut. I'm a clinical psychologist, and so we at GP Track focus a bit on telebehavioral health, a bit more than maybe the other resource centers, simply because of my interests, but all of us have various emphases that we focus on based on, you know, where we exist and what skill sets we bring to the domain.
Very interesting. And I'm sure given the Plains area, you have quite a few people that are interested. We've talked a lot on this show about how rural areas and those that are underserved, as you mentioned, have trouble accessing specialist care, and telehealth is a perfect way to do that. And we know that there's some unsureness right now because of the end of the public health emergency. We've talked a little bit about that with our listeners, but I think it's important for folks to understand that with the changes that are happening in the public health emergency, that means that there are some significant changes happening in the telehealth space in terms of how folks are going to be reimbursed, which has a direct impact on the rural areas that you may cover in the Great Plains, as well as others for a lot of different areas. And in fact, Lloyd spoke in our last interview about the DEA proposed changes that we're all thinking about. Talk to us about how you're helping your region understand those changes, keep abreast of those changes, and any advice and guidance that you might provide.
You know, one of the things that comes up, I think, fairly commonly, and that we try and help people get a grasp on, is that, and I say this all the time, telehealth isn't one thing. And in fact, telehealth reimbursement isn't one thing, and telehealth regulation isn't one thing. There are multiple levels and multiple kind of interacting regulatory domains. And so when we talk about things changing for telehealth at the end of the PHE, what we mostly mean is that federal regulations are changing and the way Medicare pays for telehealth is changing. Most of the states, all the states in my region and most states, ended their PHEs a while ago. And so a lot of that cross-state licensing stuff that's up to the states got rescinded. And most Medicaid agencies, which is the other major public payer, have, at least in my region, and I think across the country it's probably fair to say, have developed their, if you will, post-PHE approach to telehealth. A lot of them expanded, a lot of them changed some things, they recognized some new codes, some new providers, they did whatever they're going to do, and they have more or less made those changes permanent as much as anything is permanent. I mean, regulatory issues change from time to time. So when we talk about the end of the PHE, we just want to make sure that we're not saying, oh my goodness, everything is changing.
Right.
Medicare is changing and federal regulations. And so helping people understand that. And to the extent that they do Medicare business, of course, you got to be aware of that. And the other two things, I mean, there are three big things that are changing. One is Medicare, one is the DEA, and one is OCR and HIPAA regulations. Yeah. Those are all the federal level changes. And so you got to be aware of, you know, if you're using a non-HIPAA compliant platform, obviously fix that.
Right.
If you are doing a lot of prescribing of controlled substances, especially if you're doing substance abuse work, then be aware of what the DEA changes mean. And there are some changes that pretty significant ones there. And I don't think we're done with those yet. We have yet to see the final rule, and there could be some movement there. So everyone's looking at that, watching
any minute now, as a matter of fact.
What's that?
Any minute now.
Any minute now, right, right. which is part of what makes telehealth so great and so crazy at the same time. Because yeah. It's like, yeah, it's not true. It was true last week. Now it's not true anymore. But anyway, those two changes. But then the third major one, of course, is how Medicare reimburses. And interestingly enough, too, even that's just not one story, because the substance use and mental health, the behavioral health domain, there were a lot of permanent changes that happened in the middle of the PHE that are continuing in a permanent way. Mental health is covered differently at FQHCs now, or at least it's regulated differently at FQHCs and RHCs now than it was. The patient's home as an originating site is different now in telebehavioral health services. So, and then there's a lot that's been extended. All of those Medicare reimbursement core services have been extended now for till the end of 2024,
yes.
With a few little nooks and crannies where it's different, and that causes some anxiety. But by and large, the meat and potatoes, I mean, the big stuff is out till 2024. So at least we have a runway there to be making adjustments and, you know, making some plans.
Yeah, exactly. And that's a good point that the government did think ahead, which doesn't always happen in the government. They did think ahead and extended a lot of these changes through 2024 to give themselves and healthcare a really an off ramp or ramp up time, give them time to analyze what had happened during the COVID pandemic and also what the needs are. And so they are collecting actively data to determine what has happened during that time. How did people use telehealth? How should they use telehealth? And I would add to your comment there about the states, not only have the states sort of already in their PHEs, the majority of them, and I think all of them at this point certainly have ended for the state level, but each of those states has made a thoughtful analysis of the telehealth usage in their state and either, as you mentioned, kept regulation the way it was or changed it slightly. But in addition, I see now they're doing, quite a few states are doing some analyses of their state telehealth programs and what they should do. Cause there's this whole, you know, we don't want to use too much jargon, but the whole idea of parity of payment, right? So parity of payment, meaning that you should get paid the same as you should get paid for a face-to-face visit. As you mentioned, home being a valid site for mental health services. So these are the kinds of things that we see the government doing, which is a good thing. And I know that as a HRSA-funded organization, you are not permitted to lobby per se or advocate on behalf of your members or the folks that are existing in your states, but the education that you're providing is really getting to the core of that to help organizations understand exactly what is happening. And all the TRCs are doing that. And I know that you've got a big education session coming up here in May, on May 23rd and 24th in Minneapolis. I know you love to do this at the Mall of America, which is a great location for that session. Talk to us about this program, who should attend, and the types of things that you are educating the public on.
Sure. We and a number of TRCs do conferences like this, and all of us have thought about this quite a bit. What is our role in the telehealth space? There it seems like, you know, telehealth conferences have kind of sprouted like mushrooms across the country in the last couple of years, and they're all looking at different niches and different ways of promoting telehealth. And I think it's partly because there's a lot of demand for understanding. What we try and do, and I think this is true across all TRCs, what we try and do is, number one, provide a very regional focus. Now, what's going on in our region? It's not that people from outside our region can't come. We'd love to have you.
Yeah.
But we want to highlight programs that are going on, you know, in our region. And closely related with that is get those folks talking to each other. Because we have found over the years, telehealth programs, by and large, at least at the operational level, they love to connect with each other and figure out, okay, how are you solving this problem? What are you doing about this? What are you thinking? You know, when May 11th comes, how are you going to change? You
right.
know, all of they love to talk about that with each other, and we want to promote that, be a sort of a convener of those sorts of experiences. And then related to that, we focus, the TRC conferences focus on the operational level. So although we want to expose attendees to, you know, what's coming in the future, what are the technologies and the development there, what are some cool things in the startup space, that's all interesting and we need to be aware of that. But our conferences are not primarily focused on technology or primarily focused on the startup space. They're primarily focused on operations. How do you run a telehealth program? What do you need to know? What do you need to do? What are best practices? How do you make that run smoothly? Granted, you know, what's coming and all the regulatory things you have to be aware of and what you might have access to in terms of technologies and companies and services and whatnot out there in the space. So across that, you know, across the telehealth domain, which is huge and growing, we try and have a pretty clear regional and operational focus that can be really of use to existing programs that are doing telehealth and trying to do it better.